All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Jake Dunlap Show. We are very excited that you joined us. If you haven't tuned in, this is the show where we talk to celebrities, thought, and industry leaders to really discover their journey to success. I am super excited that you're joining us. This show is like no other. I can promise you that. You might laugh, you might cry, but you will definitely leave inspired and gain a whole new level of insight into those people that you follow, love, and admire. All right, welcome everyone to another episode of The Jake Dunlap Show. I am very, very excited for our guest today. And let's see if you can guess it. You know, this is something that we try to do with every episode. So today's guest is one of the most influential women in business today. She's really distinguished herself as a speaker, an author, an entrepreneur, and has been recognized by Business Week, Business Insider, Forbes, LinkedIn, and a ton of other people as an expert in her field. She's a social media master and has worked with direct-to-consumer brands like Mary Kay, Tupperware, and even the U.S. Navy, among many, many others. She is called the Zen Master of Marketing. That's a good title. Like, I want to be known as like the Zen Master of something. A millennial master of the universe. Please join me in welcoming today's guest, one of the very first Twitter users, Shama Hyder. Shama, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really looking forward to the talk.
Hey, Jake. Pleasure to be here. Excited to be on your podcast, man.
It's going to be good. It's going to be a lot of fun for people to get to know you in particular. You've got a really interesting story, obviously roots here in Austin. So shout out to that as well, too. So we're going to jump into it. So like every episode, we'll start in the beginning. And I think, you know, for you, you have a story, actually like many of our guests here. So you were actually born in Goa in India and lived there for the first, what was it, 9 years before you moved to the States?
Yeah, so born in Goa, but then quickly shipped over. So my mom grew up in Goa. It's very different cultural, Indian cultural. India has a lot of regions, mm-hmm. for those who don't know. So every state, every region has a very distinct culture and feel. And then grew up in Bangalore, actually, which is kind of like the Silicon Valley of India is what they call it. So spent my formative years there and then moved to New York and then Texas. And so, yeah, migrated to the U.S. when I was 9 years old. So learned a few things very quickly.
I was wondering, let's go back to that. So what was it like? I mean, what was it like for you those first kind of 9 years? Like, what are some of the big memories you have, whether it's about, you know, family or school?
Yeah, so, you know, I have really fond memories of my time in India. I was a very sick child, I am told. Now, I don't have memories of this, oddly enough. Maybe it was so traumatic, right. I haven't blocked out. But my parents say I was in and out of hospitals a lot, and just wasn't a very healthy child. Something changed when I turned 13, 14, and for the most part, I've been a rather healthy young adult and adult. So, but the memories I do have is, you know, spending a lot of time with family. I'm very grateful I got to spend a lot of time with my grandparents and three living grandparents at the time. To both my parents, both my dad's parents passed away rather young in their 50s. So I was really grateful. And just shortly after we left the country, oddly enough. So got to spend a lot of time with them. And yeah, some of my fondest memories are just spending a lot of time with my grandparents. As a parent now, yeah. I feel like I put a lot of emphasis on my children's relationship with their grandparents because I have such great memories, and I recall feeling really loved and just kind of a little bit of spoiled from all the family. And then school was really interesting. I can't say I loved or thrived at school in India like I did in the U.S., and I'm happy to talk more about that. But it was fascinating because, you know, school there, the Eastern education system in general, it prioritizes a lot of discipline. It prioritizes a lot of falling in line. I mean, certain things that are good for you, sure. You know, when you're trying to be like as a child. But I don't think I was ever kind of a march to the beat of everyone's drummer type person. So I chafed a little bit under that. I mean, school wasn't, I just didn't care so much about school, which really changed when I moved to the U.S. Funnily enough, moving from India to New York was a more positive experience than moving from New York to Texas.
Interesting. Well, I could, there's a lot of things we can get into there. So what was the big reason for the move? Like, what was the reason that your family moved?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, like most immigrant parents, right, or immigrant families, it's for a better life. It's to have more opportunities, that sort of thing. But ours was a little more politically motivated too, because my grandfather on my father's side was the equivalent of what you would consider a senator here, right, in the U.S. System. So, and because they were a minority party, there was a lot of political strife. You know, my grandfather championed one of the first women's girls' school in his village. Like, there's just a lot of religion plays such a big role in India. So just all these things in politics and combined. And my dad was, was inclined towards politics and entering that field. And I think the matriarchs, particularly my grandma and my mom, were like, nope, we're not doing that. That's not safe. We're not doing that to the girls. And so I think it was really with that urging. They said, you go get out of here. This is not. There have just been a couple of incidents. I have one particular story. I remember my dad sharing when he was a young man, and my grandfather was in some sort of meeting, some sort of council meeting, and they had sent, I don't really know what the word for it is, but like villains.
Okay. Villains.
I don't know. I mean, these people essentially to scare and to potentially harm, right, the council. So you had all these like bad guys outside my grandfather's office, and my dad and a couple of his young buddies, like they were in their early, like, late teens, early 20s, were in there, and they had to get these guys out safely. And so my dad still has a scar on his forehead from the accident, because he said they didn't have any weapons. These guys had hockey sticks, and like it was like a very like a scene from a movie, right? So I don't think he'd met my mom at this point, but they'd so he grabbed the chains off his bike, and so they like this.
It's
so
fight.
Surreal to talk about. But yeah, it was like a literal street fight to get my grandfather out of there safely. Wow. And so that just gives you kind of a feel for the climate, the political climate, if you will. And so I think part of the move here was, hey, more opportunities, better life, but also like safety, just physical safety, And
how long were you in New York?
It was tough, man.
So you first moved to New York.
First moved to New York, very short stint, loved it. The schools were excellent. I'll always have a really fond place in my heart for upstate New York. I'll always be very grateful to my fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Scary, shout out, who, despite the name, was not scary, was very kind.
Yeah, that's like an easy one as a kid to be like, she's got to be like either really nice or really play into it.
So she was really awesome, and she worked really hard to help me assimilate and recognize that it must have been pretty scary for a 9-year-old to be kind of thrown into this new environment. And so a couple of years ago, I wrote her a thank you note. So much of my life has been, so much of my life I can honestly credit to so many positive things to teachers, like teachers who made a huge difference in my life. And she was definitely, one of them. So we get to New York. We love it. And by we, I mean my sister and I. The schools are amazing. The teachers are great. We're seeing snow for the first time in our lives.
Right.
We're thrilled. My dad had come here a year earlier, so he'd kind of settled some roots. He'd gotten us a place, and we were just very thrilled to be here, finally reunited with my dad. My mom, on the other hand, was like, what is this weather? Because coming from India, she'd never, as kids, like, open to everything, right? You're like, great, snow, yay.
Right, right, right.
Meanwhile, my mom was like, I cannot stand the cold. Like, you need to go find us a place south, like as south as we can get, so we can get back to warmer temperatures and warmer climates. So hence, we moved from New York, so Kingston, New York, upstate to Texas and Dallas specifically. And that was quite a change, really different education system, really different. You go from a class with like, I think my fourth grade class had six, eight kids, like very small, to Texas where it was like 30 something kids. I got thrown into ESL, which I spoke English fluently. I just didn't speak Spanish. So they kept speaking to me in Spanish and I didn't respond. So they were like, better just throw her into. And it took them a couple of weeks to figure out that, you know, English wasn't a problem. I just didn't speak Spanish. Sure. But because of, you know, my skin tone and whatnot, they
people just assumed. They're like, oh yeah, we're just and then you're like, no, I'm good.
Yeah. So, I'm like, sorry, different kind of brown. Yeah, exactly. There's Spanish.
In Dallas, I don't know, maybe either. It's like, it's insane.
Well, early 90s, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
So, all right. So you're now in Dallas. Obviously, again, pretty big difference. I mean, even the move to Kingston, again, a town like that, that's not, you know, large. What are some things you remember, you know, like growing up there? Like, what were some of those lessons that really stand out, you know, as you think about like kind of like pre-high school? So you're going, it's a totally different climate, you know, from a culture standpoint. What are some things that stand out for you in kind of that early, I guess, adulthood slash like teenage years?
Yeah, I remember feeling very lonely and that I didn't belong, right? But I also wanted to find kind of my place. So in many ways, probably not that much different than a lot of 12, 13, like, you know, kind of that. How when you're in your early preteens, you feel that way in general. But certainly, I think added to that was new culture, new. Even though I spoke English, it's just different, right? I had a very strong accent. Obviously, moving here from a different country, we were. I mean, for lack of a better word, poor. We didn't have resources. We were living. Our first place was like one tiny one bedroom apartment. I went from having lots of family and kind of being doted on by my grandparents to no one and right. being a latchkey kid. I was responsible for my sister. So I remember feeling very lonely. I remember feeling like I had a lot of responsibility. Like it was like, man, how, you know, I remember going to bed thinking, how can I better support my parents who are struggling to put like food on the table? And, you know, we went from a really, like, I never thought about these things as in India, but now it's something we talk about. It's something I think about. School was interesting because I distinctly remember one report card where a teacher wrote that the other kids are mean to Shema, but she finds other things to succeed at. And I thought that was a really good summation of those years. Wow. Because, yeah, I just found other things. You know, I did a lot of writing, so I found my love for communication at an early age. I entered like all these contests and things and I started winning them. So I did like short stories and poetry and spelling bees. Later on, I'd go on to do oratory in high school. Little did I know that would open up. Like, I never thought I'd be a keynote speaker. I don't think most kids think about that as a revenue stream or career path. But all those things would pave the way. You know, today it's so funny because I have a genuine kind of love for the underdog and for like what I consider the hidden gems. And through my work, right, through my work, through what I do, it's so much about it is amplifying it and help them kind of navigate like the rocky terrain. But if I, you know, start looking back at it, connecting the dots, it's kind of what I had to do as a kid. So some of it comes rather natural, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. And your parents during this time, they had their own things going on as well too, though. They were, you know, starting their own, I think from what I understand, you know, I think your dad had opened his first convenience store. I know he drove a taxi for a little bit, but then, you know, saved up. And your mom, I think, had her own business. And so, like, do you remember your parents being, you know, I guess like entrepreneurial, or do you have any, you know, kind of memories of them, you know, as they were, you know, kind of working to build their own businesses?
Oh, heck yeah. And good on you for doing all your research, Jake. So yes, I mean, you know, it's funny because we would go on vacation and I put that in air quotes for those who are listening, because we would drive through these like strip malls and we're like, what are we doing here? And my parents would start scoping out a location for something. And my sister and I would be like, no, this is terrible. This is not what we signed up for. So it was just, yeah. I mean, look, when you grow up with parents who are entrepreneurs, and especially with all the challenges my parents had, you know, new country, new rules, all this stuff, you learn a lot. Cause it's forget dinner time talk. It's everything, right? Like, I remember on the weekends, like helping stock shelves and doing things. And Just, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, what were they going to price the drinks? Like, these were regular conversations. I didn't actually fully realize how not normal this was until I was much older and I had friends, because they didn't really have friends at this time in life. I really struggled to make friends when I was younger because I just had so many responsibilities, and my head was in a different place. It was like being a little adult in many ways. But I remember, you know, having friends later on, like 19, 20, and them not knowing what credit is, and like, you know, not understanding, I don't know, certain, yeah, like yeah, blew my mind. But, you know, my dad had gotten a credit card for me when I was 16 years old under my name and said, I'm going to start buying stuff on this and paying it off. It builds your credit. And I was like, okay.
Every parent, like, I am shocked. My parents, I'm more like my parents did not do that. But it's like, gosh, what a smart move by your dad.
Yeah. And so there was just so much that he taught me, you know, a lot. And again, it's always in retrospect that you really appreciate these lessons. So for me, like working hard, and I got to tell you, I hear all these conversations today about student loans. And, you know, my heart really goes out to a lot of these students that are struggling for that. But for me, like I graduated debt free. I worked, you know, I worked two jobs. I took with the whole understanding that just this opportunity, that's the gold. Like getting to pay for it is a privilege. You know, you figure it out. You do what you have to do. So I think that kind of immigrant mentality was set from a young age, where I feel I never growing up, I still to this day, I never like that sense of entitlement we just didn't have growing up. And that's something I'm really grateful for, because I look at some peers and I look around and sometimes the level of entitlement today, or people feeling, you know, like they're the victims of something. Not that there's not real life cases for that, but just kind of the miasma of that whole thing, you know, blows me away sometimes.
Yeah. I've talked a lot about this, like nobody owes you anything, which is like this, somebody didn't respond to me or something. It's like, they don't owe you anything. What do these people owe you something? Like, because you put in hard work, like hard work is the prereq. And I think a lot of people are struggling with that concept of like, well, I didn't see the result or the outcome. And, you know, what I talk a lot about too is just sometimes you don't see that outcome for 2 or 3 years. It's like that project that you did that didn't go anywhere. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, I remember when I did that thing. And I think so many people were looking so much at the short game. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But all right, we'll get into that later. So next up, high school. So you go to high school. What kind of student were you in high school?
So interesting. So something interesting that happened when I got in, when I got here to the US, they tested me in the fourth grade when I was in New York, and they told my parents, we can bump her up to seventh. Like, we can bump her a few grades because she tested out. Part of, I think, the Indian education system, it's rather, you know, the math and science, especially, it's a little more advanced. So my parents said, absolutely not. They said, she's 9. She looks 7. We're not putting her with a bunch of 12-year-olds, not happening. So anyway, so I share this because I kind of skated through school until about 7th grade, where it caught up to me and I was like, oh, wait, I'm behind. Because until then, I really, like, I didn't have to try. I didn't have to do anything. It was like, I felt like I was repeating classes. Now, 7th grade, I find myself falling behind. But again, rescued by an amazing teacher who, by the way, I've yet to find, and I hope that one day our paths cross. He was at that middle school very temporarily. His name was Michael Weeks. In case anybody listening knows of Michael Weeks.
All right, Carrollton, Texas, I think, right?
Yes, who taught at Vivian Field Middle School. And he, you know, like all, I think schools with budget issues, public schools with budget issues, he taught like multiple classes. Yeah. So he was my English teacher, my history teacher. I'm surprised they didn't have him doing like home ec and arts and all that. But you know, he, like, I distinctly remember one day in class, and I used to sit all the way in the back, called me, asked me to stay after class. And I was like, it's weird, because I'd never get into trouble. So it wasn't like one of those things, but no teacher had stopped me before. And he stopped me and he said, listen, Ms. Hyder, I can tell that this is really boring for you. And I promise I will do my best to up the ante, to challenge you. Just hang in there with me for a little bit. And I was like, So I left. I'm thinking maybe he confused me with someone else. Like, this is so weird. Like, no one has said this to me before. And true to his word, he did. He gave me special assignments for some reason. And when I read something out loud, he made the class stand up and applaud, much to my chagrin.
Oh, gosh.
Right? Because you're like, ah. But yeah, mortifying, but also weirdly, like, encouraging, because I was like, was it that good? Like, I didn't think so, right? But so I aced both his classes, and that was a turning point for me, because I thought, you know, like, there's someone who believes in me, and maybe I'm not, maybe I do have a shot at this thing called school. I don't know. Unlike my sister, who was always like a straight A student, perfectionist, I was kind of the optimizer. Like, how can I optimize my way through school? That's well, making right. sure, like, I help my parents get food on the table or whatever they needed, you know, whatever, like, not just financial, but kind of emotional support. Being the eldest, I just really felt that responsibility. So, so by the time I finished seventh grade, and we had obviously a high school that, you know, our school fed into, but there was also another high school that had a magnet program for media arts and technology. They did media arts and technology and one for biomedical sciences. And I thought, you know, maybe I was shot. Like, why don't I apply here? So I did, and I got in. So my high school was an amazing experience. And it was at what I would call a struggling high school, right? Very like public school, kind of put it in, pick one out of anywhere in the US and you'll find kind of the same similar challenges. But this magnet program made a huge difference because it pulled in students from different all through the district. So it wasn't just the school you were assigned, and they had great teachers. Cisco sponsored, like, I'll always be appreciative of certain brands, right? That's what I started to learn about, like, brands and how they worked, because I did my Cisco certified network administrator certification pretty much in 2 years. And, in high school, taking apart Ethernet plugs, and meanwhile I was mastering PowerPoint, which sounds silly today, but like that was a big deal.
Oh my back gosh, then. That's what kids should be learning now. It's like, I feel like now, like, you've got a small one too, so it's like, I want my son, like, teach him how to Google stuff, like, teach him like these practical skills, you know, like, versus you know. How to, like, I was like, if they ever try to teach my kid the Dewey Decimal System, like, he's out, like. There's just no point.
So, yeah, it's interesting because certainly things like what does learning mean changes, right? Like, not just being able to search something, but, and people were like, oh, you shouldn't teach kids how to search. I'm like, yes, you should. And you should teach them how to tell the difference between what's legit and what's not, because that's their future, right?
Exactly.
So it was really fascinating. I had a great high school experience, graduated top 10 in my class, went on to UT with a full ride. I would say throughout my schooling, my high school was probably my favorite just because I got to do what I loved every day. We had a whole production studio. Like, I didn't know at that time that I was going to run a PR marketing firm. We'd work with B2B companies. Like, obviously, you don't even know what this is when you're in high school. But my first internship was at a PR firm in Dallas. Like, there was just so much that I got an opportunity to learn, and I was incredibly grateful for.
So let's talk about UT. So you come down here to Austin, go to UT. So what are some, like, big memories that stand out? Because pretty much after you graduate and get your master's, I mean, you're kind of almost immediate into entrepreneurship, right? You're like, I've had enough. Like, I'm not doing that. And so, like, what are some memories you have of UT? And then also, you know, do you remember any moments where it's like, I'm going to be an entrepreneur? Like, I don't want to work for anyone, you know, like, as you were, like, going through college, or, like, you know, kind of tell me a little bit about some of the experiences maybe you had at UT and how that formed you eventually starting your own, you know, business.
Yeah, Jake. So I got to start here. So even though, I graduate from high school, and, you know, I was probably feeling more entrepreneurial out of high school than I did once I got through college, which is interesting.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I thought I'd want a job. I mean, because the thing is, yes, I saw my parents do that, but they're
working.
They are working, and it did not make entrepreneurship attractive. I was like, nuts, right? Like, I don't want to be these guys. Yeah. Like, what Sunday? What Saturday? Exactly. Like, I don't, you know. But it's also interesting because, you know, so, like, my parents were amazing entrepreneurs. They worked so hard for their family. But looking back, my sister and I always comment, but, like, they were so poorly resourced, bless their hearts. Like, they had no mentors. They had no people helping. Like, they were just figuring this out on their own every day. And I feel like entrepreneurship today is so different. I mean, you know, I credit so much of my success just in the last few years to my business coach. Like, we have so many resources today to do better. But anyways, I want to answer your question because here's the other thing I figured out in high school. Because by this point, I'd gotten, like I told you, it's always trying to find paths that were optimized. Like, how can I, right, like, shortcut this? How can I do this better? And so when I was in high school, I realized there was a program. They did a terrible job marketing this, by the way, because nobody knew about it except me and then eventually, like, three of my friends. You could take community college classes while you were in high school, your junior and senior year. And I was like, wait, I can take, like, yes, why wouldn't I do this? So I spent evenings and summers while I was in high school taking classes at Brookhaven Community College, right? So this is part of Dallas Community College. And I have to tell you, it was one of the best experiences of my life. You know, community colleges are so underrated. They attract great people who love teaching. They're not necessarily into it for research, obviously. Like, they're into it because they like teaching the students. Yeah. So had just great professors. And by the time I graduated high school, I entered UT as a junior because I had enough credits.
That's so smart.
So
how do you feel like you have that foresight, Shama? As you, like, think about that, like, you know, I just feel like so many, like, to think ahead, and maybe it was just like, I don't know, it seemed like a cool opportunity, but, like, is there anything you think about of, like, what do you feel like gave you that foresight to say, well, why, of course I should just do this. Like, this is going to pay off.
Money, Jake. We were poor.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Like, I was like, it's like, you know, asking my parents, like, what, do we have a college fund? And they're like, no. What's that? no, look, I mean, as immigrants, we'd already, look, we'd achieved success. My parents had bought a house for us. They built their own successful, you know, businesses from being blue collar workers to, and they were brick and mortar, right? Like, they were brick and mortar businesses. But yeah, they were small business owners. And so, I mean, by that point, I was like, man, look, I've got to think to the future. What do I want to do here? How can I, you know, and I, at this point, I also really loved school. Something had occurred in those years where I fell in love with, I loved reading. I've always been a voracious reader. You rarely find me without a book or finishing one. Like, I have books all over the house. I read on my Kindle. And so, but I never equated that to, like, school, because the Indian schooling system is very different. As I got older, I realized, no, all these things are the same. Like, you know, again, and I'm so grateful for all these opportunities that I had, from Cisco to Sony sponsoring, like, a camp for, you know, for youth that needed it, aka your parents didn't have time that summer to do much with you and you didn't have the resources to do these things. And so sponsored, like, a 2-week camp when I was in seventh grade, and I got to go to all these museums and IMAX and, like, have these experiences that we didn't have the resources, money, or time to, you know, and just, so I do think exposing, by the way, we'll just say this, I think exposing minorities and underserved communities with these kind of opportunities is massive, because you can't be what you can't see, and you don't know what's out there because you don't know what's out there. And as a child, your world is pretty small, right? Like, it's only what you're exposed to. So so these opportunities, I think, are what helped me to say, there's got to be more out there, and I got to start seeking them out. Like, at Brookhaven, there was a whole, like, there's a whole administrative section. I mean, they're paying people full-time salaries, and this was back in the day, but, like, to run this program, but no one in my high school knew about the program. Like, you know, I found it back in the day. I don't think even Google existed, but, like, whatever, GeoCities, Angel List, like, good old Yahoo and AOL, right? And calling people, like, picked up the phone and they said, yeah, let me connect you to that office. And I was like, this thing has an office? Like,
nobody's doing
it's a program, it has an office. So entered UT as a junior. Really regretted it from and by regretted it, I mean UT was a huge school, and that was hard. I mean, I'd gone from community college, small towns, you know, like really close knit community to this huge place. And it was such a culture shock, like in so many ways. I think, you know, as at 18, I was very naive. Like, look, I'll share this one story with you just so you can get an experience of my college. Yeah, this will sum it up for you. So my freshman year, I'm in my dorms at UT, and someone says there's going to be a party tonight. And in my head, in my 18-year-old young girl head, I'm thinking, party? Like, the only party I know is a birthday party. So I'm thinking, you wear a dress, and there's cake and balloons.
Wow.
Like,
wow.
Like, and I'm like, I love parties. Sounds great. So, of course, I put on a dress, and, like, and I walk down to this thing, and I'm looking for a house. I'm looking for balloons. Like, where's... And I walk into a warehouse, and it's this warehouse with red cups, you know, like the red Solo cups, and music blaring, and it smells like it reeks of alcohol. And it's not pleasant. If you didn't grow up around, it's not a pleasant smell, right, to just like, you know, you're walking in, I see people making out in corners. Like, it feels sleazy to me. Like, at the 18-year-old me walks in and is like, what is this? And then I'm like, I asked someone, I'm like, where's the food? And they're like, there's no food. I was like, but there's cake, right? Like, there's... They said it was a party. So till this day, my friends joke and they know not to call it a party. Right. Like, they know not to call things a party unless there's going to be cake or chips. Like, why would you do that to me? So then someone from my high school, like someone who knew me from home, spots me, who went to UT. It's a big school. And he was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, I don't know. I was told there was a party, but there's no cake. I'm very confused. And he could see, like, I was on the verge of tears. So he was like, let me walk you back to your dorms. And I was like, okay. So that was, like, pretty much the start and finish of my cultural part. Like, that was it. I mean, I was so turned off. I was like, I can't, this is not going to be a fun 3 years, whatever. So I got really focused. I ended up finishing college. I was hoping to do it in 2 years, but I got ill in the middle, and I went through some personal stuff, and so graduated in 3 years. But again, another hack, they told me I could only take 15 hours of classes. And I was like, why? That seems so less. Like, that's not a lot of classes. So it's like, you know, you've got 5 classes, 3 credit hours, about 15 hours a semester. And I'm like, 5 classes a semester? That's like, that seems really low. I could take more. And I scoped out the local community college there. And I was like, I can start taking classes here too. I don't need to take like government at UT. I can just take these classes over here. And they said, well, you can't take more than 15. I'm like, why not? They're like, I don't know. You got to go talk to the dean. So I'm like, okay. So I make an appointment with the dean. I walk in. I've got this whole thing about why I should be allowed to take more than 15. And the assistant, of course, is like, oh, you know, how can I help? And I'm like, I'm here to petition the dean to take more than 15 hours a semester. And she goes, just a second, pulls out a form, goes, please fill this out. And it said, the form pretty much said, I want to take more than 15 hours. I understand what this means. Sign here. I signed it. She was like, approved. You may take more than 15 hours. So from that point on, I took about 18 to 21 hours a semester, and I did not find it tedious. I found it a good pace. I did really well. I graduated with a 4.0. In fact, when I graduated, I then went right into my master's and ended up getting my master's at the same school. So I actually spent 5 years at UT getting my bachelor's and master's.
I love it.
Though initially I'd only planned to spend 2.
Well, that's good though. I mean, like, I think again, like, it's, I mean, I'm interested to hear how you kind of like evolve. Like, is there a point where party becomes, you know, you actually, you know, go to a party at some point? But how did you make the point, you know? So then, I mean, pretty much out of college, you founded Zen Media, right? I mean, pretty much like out of the masters. Like, how, again, how had your mindset shifted from, you know, wanting to, you know, not go that path to being like, nope, I'm starting my own thing?
Yeah. So one, I never partied. It just never worked. Like, logically, it never made sense to me. I was like, I don't ever see anything good ever coming out of any of my friends going to Caleb.
No, not at all.
Good. And you know, I was always one of these people that I had a good time in my own head. I know it sounds silly, but like I didn't feel like I needed that. So at the end of a tough test or something, like, oh man, I really need something. And I'd be like, okay. Like I didn't understand that. You know, I just moved on to the next thing. And so, so it wasn't my scene. And to this day, I don't drink. I just never picked up the habit. Like just never. Yeah. In my sphere, it didn't work that way. So now your question about me starting the company. Yeah. So some fascinating things. One thing I didn't mention to you was that I was a Dream Act student, meaning I was an illegal student taking classes at UT, because one of the fascinating things about the American immigration system is, so when you turn 21, you get kicked out of your parents' file. So you are now on your own. So even though I came here when I was 9 years old and we started the process for legalization and, you know, doing all those things, because it hadn't gone through by the time I was 21, he kicked me out. Like I all of a sudden had no status, nothing. I was like, wait, what just happened? And they said, you're on your own. You're officially an illegal immigrant. And but the Dream Act, essentially, for those who don't know, obviously, what that is, it's legislation that was passed to say if you were brought into this country under the age of, I don't know, whatever, 14 or whatever it is, and you've made this your home, then you should have some sort of path to citizenship, all right? And I fell into that category. Now, certain states like Texas actually allowed you to go to in-state schools and pay in-state tuition if you were a Dream Act student who'd also graduated like top 10% of your high school and whatnot. So I checked all those boxes. So I did. I was very lucky. I was fortunate. Even though I had a scholarship, could afford it because I got, you know, I was considered an in-state student. But it was challenging because, look, I couldn't even take the GRE to get into grad school because you need ID. And I didn't have an ID, Jake. Like, the only airline that would let me fly to see, by the way, I had a boyfriend at this time, long distance. He went to Vanderbilt. The only airline was Southwest that would accept my janky school ID to fly. I had no license. I had no state ID. So we tried to go take the, like, I applied to these companies and I didn't have papers, but even then I was like, I'll figure it out. Let me see. But you know, even then I think destiny had other plans because these companies, these big companies that later became clients, so it was in a bad ending to the story, looked at me and said, we don't know what social media is. We don't think this has a future. It's a fad. You know, Twitter, never heard of it. Like, just such early days. And so, I mean, all those things I think really culminated to me being like, look, I'm passionate about this. I'm not going to sit around and do nothing. So that's how I put out my own shingle. Because to start a business in the U.S., you don't need to. They will gladly take your tax money.
That's right.
So you can pay your taxes. And so I did. So it was a really interesting journey from, you know, all kinds of hurdles to not getting a job. And the legal kind of status was the least of it. I mean, the biggest was that they didn't feel like any of the things that I'd studied. I did my thesis on Twitter when it had 2,000 users, that any of it had any, you know, any merit in the real world.
How did you, I mean, so as you start this off, and I know, I mean, I think we're gonna have to do like a quick part two at some point, because I feel like we're just like now getting into some of the, all the amazing things you've done recently. But for those of people who are listening to this, you know, that you wrote the first book on social media in 2010. You know, like you were talking about social media, you know, when Facebook was like, you know, just kind of going mainstream, like you said, Twitter, LinkedIn still wasn't even a social media, but still a jobs platform then. You know, what do you feel like, you know, and again, obviously you won a ton of awards early on for, you know, your entrepreneurial work and, you know, different things that you've done, been honored by the White House. What was it about social media? You talked a little bit about this, and obviously then it's kind of evolved into, you know, broader marketing. You know, what are some, I guess, like trends or things that you saw early that, you know, you really, you, I guess you realized that you were ahead of the game. You know, you, I know you launched your Shama TV on YouTube in 2012. I mean, so you're early into this. And what was it for you that you saw, you know, when you started the firm that, wow, like this is going to be massive? You know, like what, like, do you remember some of those early conversations?
Yeah, I do, Jake. And, you know, the, to me, what was so exciting was that it was this great equalizer, right? Like if you had good ideas and you could make it happen. I mean, remember, not only was I talking about marketing and kind of, social media and marketing in the digital age, I was walking the talk. I started the company. I was 22. I had $1,500 to my name. I had no network. Like, I didn't even know people started agencies leaving other agencies. No one told me these things. Okay. Yeah, this was early days, but the buzz was there, right? Like, I remember being at South by Southwest, and there were 200. The Interactive had just launched. Literally, that was Interactive. And now Interactive is South by's biggest, biggest platform. I'm actually going to be speaking there in March. So this will be my second time speaking at South by. So it was just interesting as a student, like 200 folks and having, you know, like, and all of this was so new. And I'm thinking, wow, this is really going to be so cool. I remember when I was in grad school, and I'll always be forever grateful to my mentor and my lifelong friend, Donna Ballard, is a professor there. And one of the first women of color, by the way, who really I learned so much from and got to see what it meant to be a woman in the workplace. And like, I'd never had that example before her in that, you know, at that level, playing at that level. And was just, she's just amazing. She's an amazing human being, aside from being a great academic. And I remember because when you're in grad school, they pay for you to go to the National Communication Association Conference. It's the NCA. You get a stipend, you get to go. It's like, but I wanted to go to Blog World in Las Vegas instead because it was one of the first conferences called Blog World and New Media Expo.
Right.
And I told Donna, it was like, I could really use that money to go here instead. It makes sense with my thesis. And she said, yeah, she's like, let's ask. Let's ask, you know, Barry, who's the head of the department, if they'll let you do it. And she said, let's just leave blogging out because nobody knows what that is. Let's just put New Media Expo. And I was like, okay. So we pitched this idea. I was like, and they approved it. So I didn't go to NCA like every other student. I went to the New Media Expo. And again, such early days. Some of the earlier players, you know, I remember being on a panel with Biz Stone from Twitter. Like, just everything was so new. And I thought, this is going to change the world. Like, you see the inklings. Like, today it's the metaverse. Like, you see these things happen early. People who saw crypto and Bitcoin early, right? Like, certain things. So I think it's not just spotting it, but conviction. And I had a lot of conviction in it. Maybe because I was young and naive, but also because I saw how quickly you could build up an audience. How quickly, like, you didn't need, you know, you didn't need a lot to be able to do that. You just needed good ideas and you needed consistency. And I was like, I got that.
And that's what a lot of people don't understand is that consistency piece that, and over time you kind of find that voice and that niche. And there's so much more here. So we've got like so much more. So I hope we can have you back to do like a much more detailed walkthrough.
I'll gladly be back. Yeah, it's
we'll do like a quick like 30-minute part two here. We had Kara Golden. We ran into the same part. But again, I think, you know, for your story and what I hope a lot of people take away is just the attitude and the figuring it out and finding new ways and that there's always a path, right? There's all these paths that exist if you just take the time and the effort to look. You know, and I think kind of weave through your stories, there's all these like opportunities where you found this and you know, didn't see a wall. You just were like, all right, well, how are we going to figure this out or et cetera. And the question I always end on though, is what trend or what are you most excited about looking forward? So when you think about your business and the work that you do with companies, are there a trend or something happening in marketing that has you really excited?
Yeah, man. I mean, and we work a lot with B2B in tech, right? So it's fascinating. I'll give you kind of two levels. I think at the B2B level, the folks that we work with, I'm really excited that you see so many more people waking up to even the power of marketing, which sounds funny to say, but for B2B companies, historically, they've always put focus on sales and product. But today, when you know, 60% of your like buying cycle, it's complete before someone talks to your salesperson, you're looking at a very different world. So I'm glad to see more and more saying like, we get it. We've got to play this game and we've got to do it right. Broader, I think the metaverse is really fascinating. And I think that's going to be our next big thing. Now, I just want to clarify, I don't think the metaverse is like a specific place. It's not like it's not a Roblox or this one VR world. I think it's where our digital identity becomes as important as our physical identity, if not surpassing it to some degree. So it's like the evolution in our species, you know, like I think it's fascinating because I was, when I first started and I used to do all these talks about social media, I talk about your digital footprint, yeah. But it's not your footprint anymore. It's your entire identity and you get to determine what that looks like. So you're not stuck with kind of who you are in the physical world. You can be a lot of things, but I think we're just starting. I mean, this is very early days, obviously. It's going to be the next 10, 20 years where, you know, metaverse becomes a thing, and then we won't even call it that because it'll be like calling the internet. You know, like cyber highway. It's not going to be like that.
I cannot agree more. I think so many people right now, and especially I think because of COVID, it's like then we're like we want to come back to this real world experience, and it's not that we won't when we aren't doing that, but every person who's listening, you have a digital footprint. Identity already. I mean, the amount of people I talk to that are, you know, later in their career, to even, you know, not even late, but mid, call it 15, 20, 30 years in, they don't even know what happens when you Google their own name. You know, they don't even comprehend, you know, it's like, what do you think people do before they meet with you? Like, what, you don't think they Google you and maybe it's your LinkedIn profile or whatever that is. You're going to have to take control of that. You're going to have to start to, you know, again, everyone's, social media is this and that. It's like, you don't have a choice. There's a million different places you can play. You don't have to play in certain ones where you don't feel comfortable. But I feel like I think that's such a great lesson to leave people with of like this concept of a digital identity over the next 10 years, it's happening, right? It's not like maybe it's going to happen and we'll go back to the good. And again, because we're on the B2B on the sales side. So we see it, people waiting for this back to the good old days or something. Like it ain't happening. Like you said, people want a self-guide. They want a person there at the right time, right? They want to not talk to a person when they not. And when they do business with someone, they want to do business. I had Jeff Gittimer last year on, and he's like, people want to do business with a somebody, you know, not a digital ghost. And so totally. I am super in line.
What I find fascinating about all of this is people get caught up in their judgment. So I know inevitably people will be like, do you think this is right? Do you think we should, you know, focus so much? Like, aren't we missing out on all these like wonderful experiences? And I'm like, sure, but this isn't about my judgment. Like, I think that's what my history has taught me, you know, is to, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what I like. It's what works. Like, I you know, this is how we're going to take meetings in the future. Like, I can sit there outside that virtual room and cry and be like, I don't like this. But that's where the meeting is. So my only choice is, do I want to be part of the meeting or do I want to sit outside and, you know, and wallow? So I think that's the other thing is people assume that I love social media or I am so gung ho. No, I have no like emotional feelings about, you know, one way or the other. I just know what works. And so I think that objectivity is very helpful in business.
I love that. And I think for a lot of people, hopefully they can kind of take that and maybe reposition the way they're thinking about it too. And I think it's the same for brands, B2B brands, that this idea of like B2B has to be boring, you know, and B2B can't have its own personality or identity that isn't, you know, this like stonewall corporate face. I think, and you know, you do this, you know, you're working with a lot more marketing teams. I think that's the other evolution is how do these corporate identities show up differently than
absolutely. This, like,
you know, well, check out our latest blog posts. Like, how many people, I always ask, like, how many of you have like 8 blogs open that you haven't read in the Latin? They're like, exactly. Right. Like, that's very 2010 of you. Well, look, Shama, I could go on for forever. I'm definitely going to hit you up to get on the show here in the next like month or so we can go through the real nitty gritty of all your amazing accomplishments over the last 10 years. But I really enjoyed this conversation. I think a lot of our listeners are going to have a ton of takeaways. So big thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Jake. This was fun.
Awesome. All right. Well, thanks, everyone. And we'll see you next week on another episode of The Jake Dunlap Show.
All right. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in to another extremely fun and interesting episode. I thought it was fun and interesting, so I hope you did too, of the Jake Dunlap Show. Really great just breaking down everything that makes people who they are, the success, the trials and errors, and I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. Make sure to subscribe on your favorite platform, and make sure, more than anything, to go over to jakedunlap.com. That's where you're going to stay up to date on all the latest guests, additional details, prep notes. We're going to be sharing everything on jakedunlap.com. So go ahead, go over there. You can subscribe there as well, too. And we will see you next week on The Jake Dunlap Show.